some person telling me that they just were leaving London on the way back to Thailand, and the flight attendants had just handed out the meal, and then there was like they heard there was a bomb scare on the plane. They had to land at Amsterdam, and straight away all the flight attendants had to snatch away the meal from people. And was that difficult? Did people did people complain? Even though there's a bomb on there, it doesn't matter, that's my meal. So that all the time that it's because my meal, because we think we own it. That's, you can get another meal later, obviously. You know, the airline will look after you. But the point is that when we sort of forget that these things are just loaned to us, that we just rent them, we look after them for a while, that's when we have possessions. When we have possessions, that's when we can get in trouble. That's when we're opening ourselves up to suffering. That's when we're opening ourselves up to being a mango tree who's going to get hurt sooner or later, because we've got too many mangoes on there. So we learn from these teachings, from these insights. And when the Ajahn Chah said, why? There is nothing. It means that you own nothing. All this stuff is rented. Belongs to nature, cause and effect, that's all. When you understand that, life becomes far more easier, because instead of forcing life, instead of acting with craving and attachment, you can tend to flow along with life. Remember that simile which I gave many years ago now, the simile of the driverless bus. Life is like you're going along in a bus, and look outside the window, and sometimes you see some really beautiful scenery. And you tell the driver, slow down, or stop, even better, because I just want to enjoy this beautiful time. Sometimes the driver does slow down. Sometimes just carries on at the old speed. Sometimes the driver even goes faster, just after you said that. And that really makes you annoyed at the driver. Sometimes you're going through some really awful territory. You don't really want to look out the window at all. It's just so desolate and so like going to a toxic dump. And you tell the driver, hurry up, get out of here fast. And sometimes the driver does do that. Sometimes the driver carries on at the same speed as before. Sometimes he even slows down and stops, which again makes you very angry. And after a while of this in life, you can understand the simile. Sometimes you have really nice experiences and you just want them to go on forever. Slow down, I really want to enjoy this. Vroom vroom, the driver speeds up. Oh. Sometimes you're going through a lot of pain and difficulty, having a really terrible time, and you want to say, get out of here, quick. And sometimes the driver slows down as if he's some sort of sadist, making you have to endure all of the pain. And after a while you get so fed up with this driver in life, you want to find out who this character is, so you can really sort him out. And that's like the religious path. We find out who is the driver, who is the doer, what is this thing that is creating all of this? Why is like life out of control? Why can't, you know, I just accumulate and keep all the pleasant experiences and sort of run away from or get rid of everything which is unpleasant? Why can't I do this? What's wrong with the driver? Why is the driver so stupid? Because that's what happens, isn't it? Sometimes we think we're stupid. When pleasure slips from our grasp, or when we get suffering, we think it's our fault. I've done something wrong. I'm stupid. Why did I say that? I shouldn't have done that. If I had it again, it will be different. We think it's our fault, the driver's fault. So anyway, the path of meditation is finding out where the heck this driver's hiding out. It's very elusive to find this driver. But eventually, after much meditation, after much insight and much practice, you eventually find out where the driver's seat is. You eventually corner the driver's seat. That's all it is, just a seat, because there's no driver in there at all. This is where you actually see the seat is empty. My me or I. Nothing there. No doer. The driverless bus is you. Now, of course, there's great consequences when you actually see this for yourself. It obviously gives you a shock. Now, how can there be no driver here? If you actually see all the controls and how it all works, the cause and effects, the nature of this vehicle you call the body and the mind. Once you see the driverless, there's no one in the seat, realizes the driverless bus, it has lots of consequences to it. What you do is you go back to your seat, you sit down there, and you stop complaining. You stop shouting out when things are going terrible. Instead of shouting out, "Get at me out of here quickly," you realize you're completely wasting your breath. You're just making more of a problem for yourself because there's no one there. This is nature. When things go really well, you don't say, "Slow down, stop, I want to stay here." You're just wasting your time. You stop complaining, you stop shouting. You stop craving. You stop attaching. There's no driver there. It's a complete waste of time. It's stupid. That's where craving starts to finish. That's where attachment ends. When you realize the driverless bus. No one in there. So this is the way that sort of insight happens. When you actually find who's responsible for all of this. You go there trying to sort them out and give them a piece of your mind. And you get all the peace of mind you ever wanted. So this is like the insight practice. And this is what will happen in your meditation. How to meditate when you go home, exactly as you've been doing now. Always in the present moment. Present moment awareness, which you've been practicing here, I hope, is just a powerful practice which you can do so often in your daily life. Whatever you're doing, just do one thing at a time. That which you have to do now. You know that one of the great teachings I always bear in mind is that teaching from the ex-British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. Because after he'd retired, in the time of the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt and Syria, and when the Middle East was just really about to go up in flames, being an ex-Prime Minister but not sort of in the office anymore, the newspaper interviewed him and asked him what he thought about the problem in the Middle East. And straight away, without any hesitation, he said, "There is no problem in the Middle East." And the newspaper reporter said, "What do you mean there's no problem? There's a war going on there. People are killing themselves. There's real bullets, real tanks. People are dying over there, and it could get worse. It's the powder keg. It might turn into a world war, who knows? You say there's no problem there, what do you mean?" And very calmly, this ex-Prime Minister said, "Look, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. That's why it's not a problem." I always remember that in my life as a monk. Because sometimes in the monastery, you look at the situation, there's just no solution. At least not at the moment anyway. Maybe tomorrow the solution might come. But if there's no solution now, it's not a problem. So you forget about it. You let it go. You're at peace. This is like mindfulness in the present moment. So at the moment, the monastery is not a problem. You're not thinking about it. Anything else is not a problem. Only what's happening now. The last few minutes of my Dhamma talk. So this is like how to put mindfulness in the present moment. Always remember again that in your daily life, no matter how busy you are, there are always golden moments where you can meditate. When you're in a traffic jam, stuck on the narrows bridge, it's a marvelous, great time to meditate. You've got a couple of minutes there when you can't do anything, so you just very quickly go into the present moment awareness. Even watch your breath as you're waiting for the traffic to move again. You get to a red light on your way to work and you have to stop for 2 minutes. Instead of like turning on your radio or thinking of all the things you have to do, just stop, become present. You know, one of the monks whose biography is in that book, Living Buddhist Masters, he was a Burmese man who got a lot of faith and inspiration in Buddhist teachings and wanted to become a monk. But he had wife and had kids, and so he realized that he just couldn't abandon his responsibilities. He was only a simple farmer, but he really wanted to become a monk. He really understood some of the Buddha's teachings and wanted to take them much further. So what he did, he worked very hard and spent very little. He did extra jobs on other people's rice fields to earn a bit more money, to be able to bring up his children and give enough to his wife that she'd be well looked after until she dies. And then he became a monk. And shortly after becoming a monk, within months of becoming a monk, he became fully enlightened and arahat. And the other monks in Burma, when they heard that, said, "Impossible. No one can become an arahat so quick after such only a few months as a monk." So they started to question him, and then they found out why he'd become an arahat so quickly. But all those years that he was working in the fields, supposedly just to get enough money to bring up his children and then to give his wife enough money to look after herself so he completed his duties, all that time he was working, he was always practicing meditation. When he had his hand on the plow, when he was plowing the fields, he'd always just be aware of that physical sensation of like the hand on the plow. He'd always be in the present moment, always contemplating, always being peaceful, just with that one thing, developing his mind throughout all the activities he had to do as a layperson. He built up such momentum in that layperson's role that when it came time to becoming a monk, he'd done all the groundwork. He just needed that last little piece of freedom of being a monk, and he became enlightened very quickly. So never think that being a layperson, you can't develop your meditation. There's so many things which you can do. So many opportunities which, if it's not pointed out to you, you can so easily waste. The opportunities are traffic lights. The opportunities at home, early in the morning. Being at peace with what you're doing, one thing at a time. Giving it full attention. And when time comes, to be able to reflect on what really this is all about. Keeping in mind you don't own anything. It's just rented. All of these reflections will be building up steam, building up your credit account. So when time comes for the next meditation retreat, you've got so much in the bank already that when you come to a retreat like this, you just soar in deep meditation and gain great insights. So never think that you can't do anything in your daily life. There's always much you can do. Just the attitude with which you do it, that is what counts. So it's already gone up to the hour now, so it's enough for this final talk. I say it's a final talk, but never say final, because there's always another talk coming up later. Somewhere, somehow, sometime. So, is there any questions or comments about some of the things I've said just now? Yeah? Is it skillful to practice dying? And if so, what is a good method? Thank you. As long as it's only practice and not the real thing in this retreat. Is it skillful to practice dying? And if so, what is a good method? Yeah, it is very skillful to practice dying. Because dying is all about letting go of the body. And actually, just in the last meditation I was doing, just to get that little bit deeper, I actually did sort of a bit of dying meditation, Maranasati. So I'm just ready to die. I'm ready to let go of everything. If you can do that sort of during your meditation, what dying means is completely abandoning the body and abandoning all this world. You're ready to completely abandon, give up, really giving up, really letting go. So if you have the mind which can die to the world and die to the body, die to thinking, die to all your possessions, die to all of the past and the future, then it's a mind which can let go. dying is the opposite of attaching. Again, that's why Ajahn Chah used to say, "Are you come here to die? You come here to die? You come here to let go?" So this is how you can practice dying. You're actually letting go of things. And letting go is like a death. Sometimes like a relationship which breaks apart and separates. It's like a death, a dying, because it's like a letting go. Now if you sort of change your career, it's like a dying. You can sometimes grieve a parting, a change. This is all that letting go. So it is extremely skillful to practice dying, because if you are developing deep meditation, you're developing letting go. If it's really deep meditation, you've got to let go of your complete body and go into the realm of the mind. If you can do that now, when it comes time to dying, when your body really goes and you end up down at Bowen O'Days or Chippers or somewhere, then this is where you can die peacefully and gracefully, because you've done a lot of practice. So this is like practicing dying. This is the best method of learning how to die well, sitting on your zafu and getting into jhanas, or at least getting close to jhanas. So that's a good method of practicing dying. Because if you always remember that you can die at any time, and no one is ever ready to die. So no one is ever ready to die. People always want another hour, another day, or another week, because you never get everything out of the way and done. And if someone comes along with you a gun, with a gun, and says, "I'm going to shoot you," so often you say, "Well, just give me another hour, just to settle my affairs, and ring up someone and fix up my will, and do this and do that, and then you can shoot me." Because it doesn't work that way. Death for most people is always unexpected, and that's a problem with it. So if you realize that it can happen any time, you always become ready to die. Are you ready to die right now? Or would you ask, "Can I have an extra hour, please? Because I want to ring up a few people and settle my affairs and tell Ajahn Yan about what to do with this and that in the monastery and goodness knows what else." You see, that's a problem. You're never ready. So a good way of practicing dying is always being ready at any moment to die. At any moment, you're ready to let go. You're prepared. If you can do that, it means you've let go of a heck of a lot in the world, attachments, and you've got everything in perspective. So that's a good way of practicing dying. Anyway, just prior to death, when the thinking mind stops and peace prevails, a white light nimitta arises. Is the awareness drawn into it? If so, what then, or where then? Okay. Just prior to death, when the thinking mind stops and peace prevails. It's not always the case with all people that prior to death the thinking mind stops. Some people keep worrying and thinking to the very end, and they struggle to the last breath, and that's really a great shame that they don't allow themselves just to die gracefully with peacefulness, and so that's what they'll take into the next birth. However, if a person's had a near-death experience, which I think is probably the person writing this, so prior to death the thinking mind stops and peace prevails and a white light nimitta arises, is the awareness drawn into it? It can be drawn into it, but the same things which stop the awareness being drawn into that nimitta right now, if it ever arises in your meditation, fear and anxiety or excitement or any of these other defilements of the mind, these can stop you going into that nimitta and stop you getting reborn in those jhana realms. So it really depends on the defilements of the mind. If, this is why, if you have gained jhanas in this life, then you know exactly what to do with these nimittas. And those things which might stop the inexperienced person from entering that light nimitta at the end of death will not sort of disturb you. You know what to do. Automatically you can just go and enter into it and go into a jhana realm. However, going into the jhana realms might be good fun because you've blissed out for many eons, but again eventually you have to come out of those realms, and again that would be a strong inclination to you in your lifetime after being reborn in the jhana realms to gain jhana in your next life, but not a necessary accomplishment. So if so, what then or where then? The jhana realms, they're interesting. The first jhana realms is called basically the Brahma realm, and the second jhana realm is where the meditation becomes even too really fixed. And the second jhana realm, third jhana realm, fourth jhana realm, you're just in this state, just one pointedness of mind, not just for one day, like for eons. I forget how many eons it is, just saying these jhana realms, but it's really a long time. And you can't converse with anyone else. You can't sort of know anyone else. The five external senses are completely done away with. Just the mind is on one thing, and one thing for a long, long time. So if Buddhas arise and pass away in the world, you can't come down and contact them. You can't even contact any other beings in the same realm. You're just in this blissful state of singleness, of perception, for a long, long, long time. So that's why it might be good fun, but basically it's pretty useless. You know, I can't get enlightened there. However, it becomes a propensity, an inclination of in your next life to go back into those experiences. The jhanas would be reasonably accessible. Does anyone have any comment about that one? Okay, it's not a good idea to absorb into the nimitta at death. It really depends what choices you've got, basically. It's not a bad option amongst some of the many which you might sort of present itself to. You might as well be blissed out for eons and sort of go to some of these other realms. However, the best thing is to just be able to... It's interesting, I never really thought about this before, how the Buddha died. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, or how he went into Parinibbana, I can't really say he died, that he went into the first jhana, and then up to second, third, fourth, up to the stage of neither perception or non-perception, and all the way down again, and back into first, second, third, and fourth. And there he Parinibbana from fourth jhana. So if you can enter that white limit, nimitta, and instead of like staying in the jhana, just give up all the jhanas as well. Give up all the nimittas. Go through the nimitta and just abandon everything, even the consciousness. And that's a neat way of ending things. However, to do this, I mean, it really depends on your wisdom, your panya, and your ability to let go of things. The thing is that the white light nimitta is a sign of you've let go of the body. If you can let go of more things, if on the death your attitude is, your inclination is just to abandon, let go of as much as you can, let go of all your attachments, let go of all your clingings, of all which you think is interesting and valuable, certainly in the material world, even in the personal world of your mind, see how much you can let go. And if you're lucky, you can get let go of the whole lot. The Nibbana. Ajahn, what can one choose in this life? Can one choose to practice Sila? We may not be driving the bus, but is there any room for volition? Can we not be skillful managers in how we respond to our drama, our karma? I prefer drama, actually. Karma. Can we be skillful managers in how we respond to our karma in creating new karma? Where does volition fit into this picture? Thanks, Jay. So, volition actually is... There is such a thing as volition. You can see it happening all the time. Willpower occurring. But the point is, it's not you doing the willpower. There is choice, but it's not you choosing. And I was telling this to someone in interviews today and said, well, if there's no choice, then you know, why are we here? Why can't we just go and eat, drink and be merry and just enjoy ourselves? It's because there is no choice that you can't do that. You've got no choice in this. You have to be here. whether you like it or not. Because when you start to see volition and choice and skillful managers, this is actually, it's a very powerful sort of thing to reflect upon. And here actually you start to see the value of like good teachers and good friends. Because you start to see that so much of what you do is coming from your associates, from your teachers, from who you hang out with. And it's so important to hang out with good people, because you'll find that you'll follow their example. You'll choose what they choose. You'll do what they do, because your volition is being conditioned by them. And that's why when the Buddha starts to arise in the world, his impact on your will, on your volition, is immense. And it's because the Buddha arises in the world and starts to teach these dhammas, everyone starts to meditate. Everyone starts to let go and do these things. And it's not you doing them, it's because the Buddha did it. And you have to follow. So you start to see all of the ingredients of this thing you call choice and will. But once you start to see some, you can't see all the ingredients because it's just too complex. Once you see some of the major ingredients of it, why did you come here? Why did you meditate? Why did you sit the extra hour? Because you chose to do it? It appears that way, doesn't it? But is that the truth? Because appearances can be so deceptive. And I like to give the story of when I went to a lecture by a hypnotist. Many of you have heard this before. The hypnotist would choose a few people, and of those, only one or two were really susceptible. And he'd hypnotize them to do something completely out of character and stupid. And it was really funny to see this person do something completely sort of ridiculous and humiliating. You know, for a group of students watching this, it was really great fun. However, what was really interesting to me afterwards was when they asked that person, what did you do that for? And they always justified it. And you question them, and to them, it appeared to them very clearly that they chose to do that. It was like standing on their head, or like singing the national anthem in the middle of like a class of rowdy students. They said they'd give some reason for it, and to them it appeared they freely chose to sing that national anthem standing on their head. And everyone else knew that they had no choice in it at all. And it becomes quite staggering to see that how what is clearly sort of something conditioned from outside, completely conditioned from outside, can appear as free will, as choice. And then you start to wonder, why do you choose to buy a certain sort of type of shoe at the shop? Why do you choose a certain type of coffee? Especially when you've listened to so many adverts on the television. Why is the advertising industry so successful? They understand conditioning and how easy it is to condition you. But everyone thinks that, yeah, these adverts, they may sort of affect other people, they don't affect me. I'm free from these adverts. I'm mindful, I can just go and buy whatever I want. You're conditioned as well. So be very careful about this thing we call will or choice. And after a while you start to see where it's all coming from. Because it's with choice we think that it's like some little being inside of you with all these levers in front of it, all these controls. You know, we can actually choose what to do, what to say, when to say it. There's no little being in there somewhere at the control panel. It's not like a pilot in a jet aircraft somewhere in your head or your heart somewhere. It's not like a self who pulls all the cords. That which does is completely conditioned. It's interesting to see this, because that's where the illusion of the self lies with a lot of people. The doer, that which does. Choice. That's me. And that's my right. I'm right to choose what I want to do, what I want to say, what I want to say. And it's interesting to see that to that which you appears to be choice is actually something completely different. Once you see that, then a lot of that which you assume to be a self disappears. The driverless bus. Once you see there's no driver at the front there driving your bus, then you don't start shouting all these orders anymore. You sit in the back and enjoy the ride. The right view on not-self of the stream enterer is the same as that of the arahat. So could you please expand on the difference between the two with regard to the triangle of view, perception and thoughts? Okay, this is the called the vipalasas. View, perceptions and thoughts. Your view creates your perceptions. Your perceptions creates your thoughts. Your thoughts creates your view. So each one of these supports the other in this circle, like a vicious cycle going round and round. If you have like 40 view about something, you will perceive in a way which justifies your view. In all of the different perceptions available to you, you will choose, without you knowing, those perceptions which fit in with your view. And of all those perceptions you have, they will tend to justify your thoughts. Out of your perceptions, this is what the bricks from which you build up your thoughts. I think this way because I perceive this way. I've actually seen it. I've felt it. I've experienced it. And all your thoughts put together make your views. And so once you get this cycle wrong at any stage, it's almost impossible to break. However, you break that cycle as far as a view of self, non-self, suffering and happiness and impermanence and all of this. You break this cycle at view, the stream enterer, where in spite of all your perceptions and your thoughts, in spite of what you want to see, you see what the Buddha saw, non-self or suffering. And view is the first thing which becomes purified. If you've got purified view, if you've got the view of an arahat, the view of a Buddha, you're a stream enterer. However, that's not enough, because your view is not enough to change the way you perceive and think. In the same way, a person knows that smoking is bad for them. They know that, but still they don't give up smoking. But it's a start. They've got to train themselves with their perceptions and thoughts. So the stream enterer has got right view, the same as an arahat, the same as a Buddha. And the stream enterer then has to train themselves. That's why a stream enterer in Pali is called Seka. They're the learner. You only get your L plates when you enter the stream. They're learners. Because this is where you can really start to let go once you've got right view. Could you please explain the door to stream entry? And I think mostly I've explained that door through anicca, dukkha, anatta, but it is really just maybe three letter boxes going into the same basket. The same seeing the insubstantiality of this, the emptiness of it, the futility of it, sort of the always changing. That's why if a person actually goes into stream entry through anicca, through impermanence, very often it's like a sort of fear comes up. And quite a few meditators have experienced this. It's like you're standing on a slope and you're always falling. You can't find a place to stay still for a moment. So that sort of nimitta comes up. It's like, you know, being on slippery ice and always falling. That's all there is. Everything is falling away. Just in every moment, and nothing is stable. And that sort of becomes quite frightening at first, because it challenges your idea that it's some place where you can put up your feet and rest. And the chair is disappearing underneath you. You put up your feet on a stool and the stool disappears as soon as you put your feet on it. The impermanence becomes that sort of strong and that powerful and that fast when you actually see it and the mind actually perceives it in that way. very often it gets an incredible fear coming up, and that fear eventually uncovers what's with being afraid, the sense of self, and then you see there's nothing there and there's no fear anymore. Well, I gave that simile of the TV and all those channels. Then I'll change that simile around a bit and say just 5 channels on the TV, and the 6th channel is the TV screen itself, the mind. And in jhanas, as if you find out how to turn the TV off, so there's nothing actually playing on the screen anymore. It's just a screen there, and it's very still. And actually, when you see that, actually, you for the first time, there's actually a blank screen. There's no movement there. And that by itself, it shows you that those 5 consciousnesses, which you thought were continuous because they've been there from the time you were born until, you know, the time you entered jhana for the first time, to be actually conscious and those things not being there is quite a shock to you. And if you've got very strong wisdom, you'll be able to infer that that consciousness, the sense consciousness, actually can stop. If they can stop, why can't the mind stop as well? If you can actually see that through inference, then again, you have stream entry. You know that all these things are subject to ceasing. That even mind consciousness is subject to ceasing. Then again, you see anatta, through cessation, through anicca being cessation. Also, if you enter a jhana, you see that not only when the TV screen is blank, that things have disappeared, you also know it's actually more blissful when the 5 senses are gone. And if you understand that the 5 senses being gone are blissful, you realize that this seeing is an irritation. It's actually not as much fun as it's cracked up to be. But hearing, much better than going to sort of a concert hall and listening to Pavarotti or the Rolling Stones, whichever turns you on. It's best to actually to cut off the sound altogether and have no sound. And all this stuff we do with feelings, we're trying to have pleasurable experiences with the body. It's best actually to turn that on. That's the joy of jhanas is better than the joy of sex. That was one of the things which really interested me when I first was a layperson. The deep meditations which people had, so they were saying that is better than sexual intercourse. And that sort of, I said that actually at a jail once, when I was talking about meditation, they really sort of stood up and said, "Yeah, I want this." But it's actually that you see that the 5 senses, not just if they're nice or if they're not nice, that's nothing to do with it. Whatever they are is an irritation, is suffering. Even at their very best cannot be compared to when they're turned off. What you're actually saying is even the very best program which you can see on television in your whole life is not as good as when the programs are all switched off and there's a blank screen there. If you see that, then you can actually see that sensory experience is dukkha. And there's a very good chance you can infer that, well, if the 5 external senses are an irritation, maybe the mind consciousness is an irritation as well. Then you can get stream entry. Sometimes on first jhana you can't do that because the mind consciousness is just a bit too blissful. But then when you go to the second jhana and a big chunk of mind consciousness has been let go of, and you think, well, I let go of a big chunk of mind consciousness and it's much more blissful. Again, the inference comes that maybe the rest of mind consciousness, if I could let go of it, would also mean more bliss. Maybe all mind consciousness is suffering. That inference leads to stream entry. You see, all sensory experience is dukkha. These are the ways, other ways, which I suggest can lead to stream entry. Basically though, without jhanas, it's really, really difficult. What's the difference between reincarnation and rebirth? Between reincarnation and rebirth, there's a very slight difference there, and it's a technical difference basically, because reincarnation literally means something has been incarnated into a new life. And it's actually something has gone across from one life to another. And the rebirth, instead of something going across from one life to another, is just a process of cause and effect. The consciousness of a last life causing the rebirth consciousness of a new life, but not exactly the same, nothing going across from one life to another. That's a subtle point, it's a very important point, which actually blossoms out into a very powerful teaching later on. When you realize there's actually nothing there going even across from one moment to the next now, because you can look at your mind, once you see the mind, once you know what the mind actually is, in a jhana again, and afterwards you just recollect this mind, then you can actually see that nothing is going across from moment to moment. It's just beautiful. It's what they say in Buddhism, like rise and fall. And when it falls, it really falls and disappears, and then something new arises. But there's no link other than a causal link. There's no essence of you going across from one moment to another. And you can see that right now if you've got very clear eyes in meditation. If you can see that happening right now, it becomes obvious that what happens when you die is the same causal sequence if you really have craving to keep on going. And it's not something you can choose, because craving is not something which you can say, yes, I'm going to crave, yes, I'm not going to crave. This is a natural process like all these other processes. If you want to end craving, you've got to sort of go through the process of ending craving. You can't just suddenly decide. It's not the way it works. Of course, it's a very important part in ordinary Buddhism, because once you accept rebirth or reincarnation, then with it comes karma, and you have the whole moral framework of life and existence. Why you should be doing good, why you should be making merit, doing good karma, and why you should be scared silly of doing anything bad, because it's going to really, really hurt you. And puts this all in perspective, and puts like life in perspective as well. But one of the things in Theravada we make a big deal about is that, okay, there is rebirth, but in this life you've got a human body. In this life you've come across the Buddha's teachings, good Buddha's teachings. Use this life to become enlightened right this lifetime. We always have the aspiration, not next lifetime, don't put it off. But may I become fully enlightened in this very life. Because the next lifetime, wherever you're reincarnated, you might not have such good conditions. In fact, the way it's usually taught, it's very unlikely you'll get such good conditions. So don't waste the opportunity. And that said so much in Theravada Buddhism, it's unlikely you'll get as good as you're getting now. We don't talk about waiting for your future life. Make the effort now. Be careful now. Get on as many retreats as you can. Become a monk, become a nun. Get enlightened while you've got a chance. So that's what we say about rebirth in Theravada. Rebirth is a process in which nothing is passed on. And what are the khandhas? And how are they held together in a bundle? They're not really held together in a bundle as such, because they're just aspects of one thing, which we call, you know, the consciousness or the stream of consciousness. You've got the body. If you've got a body, you're going to have some feeling in that body, some sensory experience. You're going to have perception of that sensory experience. You're going to have like thinking or will consecutive with that sensory experience. You've got experience, you've got consciousness of that experience. So it's just all facets of one diamond. That's why that you can't split up these khandhas and just have like consciousness without something you're conscious of, without some type of body, whether it's a mind-made body or a perception-made body, or like the coarse body of ourselves. So in these khandhas, they're just a way of looking at this thing we call body and mind, which again is splitting into two. It's a way of looking at what this thing we call being, experience, reality. That's what the khandhas actually are. And what actually happens is you see the khandhas, any aspect of them, whichever one you wish to put your attention on, rising into existence, staying just for a moment and completely disappearing. Just like the frames of these old silent movies. If you only could see fast enough, you can see that one frame is illuminated on the screen, and then well, that's going away, and before the new one is put in the frame, there's emptiness there, there's a blankness on the screen. But it's a blankness which is so fast the eye can't catch it, and then there's the fresh image on the screen, and that's taken away, and there's blankness, and then there's a new image. But it appears like there's a continuity of images there. Charlie Chaplin seems to move just as a normal person moves. You see the blankness between them. See the next one arise. Then you understand there's nothing going across. What you do actually see is this, you say there's nothing really going across, it's just this cause and effect, karma. There's an influence from one moment to the next, but it's not a material, not a physical, not a mental thing. Just cause and effect, that's all. And so that's what happens when you say that nothing is passed on. And you say, okay, how can you really know that about, you know, rebirth? You can know it because seeing right in this moment what's going along from one moment to the next. What is the illusion of continuity which deludes you into thinking you're exactly the same person as went to bed last night and woke up this morning? What's the illusion? So the person who paid to go on this retreat is the same person as sitting on the cushion now. Actually, you've got no right to be here. You didn't pay for this retreat. You should collect some more money. You're not the same person. However, there is some sort of link there, some sort of causal link. And this is where actually you see like dependent origination. You see how this causal link from moment to moment actually occurs. You don't need to see that when you die. See this right in this moment, to see how things flow. But of course, the degree of mindfulness you need to be able to see that is not the degree of mindfulness with which you're looking now. You've got to get into a jhana. You come out afterwards, then you look at this process. And you look at this process with no preconceptions. You're not looking it, searching for yourself. If you look searching for yourself, you'll always see what you imagine to be yourself. You see what you're looking for. Here you're not looking for anything. You're just completely free to let reality appear to you as it is, with no vested interest in the outcome of your investigation. And then with that sort of mindfulness, with that sort of freedom of investigation, you can see what you don't like to see. There's no one here. And then, fine, it's great. So you don't have to worry about anything anymore. And you actually understand just how there's nothing passed on from life to life, except karma, if you like. And then you realize the futility of all of this. That you can allow the process to stop only when there's no vested interest in keeping it going. When you've got no shares in the company, you don't care a fig if the company goes bankrupt. If you've got shares in it, you'd always want to keep it going. Sometimes if a person's really concerned, sometimes it's the most stupid things. And isn't it the case that we can get concerned over the most trivial things in life and think about them so much? This is human nature. It's so easy to become trivially concerned about your ashes in the house or in an urn. And you come and sort of hang out there. You won't allow yourself to get reborn in another realm until you've finished your business. That's probably what happened here. For one reason, there was many phenomena around this person's ashes, and they identified as still being their body until they were scattered. And then, having nothing to hold him there, he'd just go and get a new birth. That's what happens with ghosts. They can be attached to all sorts of things in the house, their possessions, their bits and pieces. That's just the new birth. That's the khandhas continuing on. Not the same, but there's always that karmic link there.